Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back, everyone. Today we're doing a deep dive into, well, a really influential book. It's Free to Choose, a personal statement written by the economist Milton Friedman and his key collaborator, Rose Friedman.
Yes, and this one, it really gets to the core of things, doesn't it? It asks a fundamental question, basically asking you, the listener, what's the right balance, you know, between government power and individual liberty?
Exactly. And the Friedmans, they make this really strong case that, well, if you give up your economic freedom, your political freedom is not far behind. It might not survive at all.
Mm-hmm. And what I find interesting is their goal wasn't just, you know, writing for other economists. They really wanted to arm regular citizens like you and me with the economic thinking to argue for policies that maximize choice.
And ultimately lead to more prosperity, right?
That's the idea.
So before we unpack the arguments, maybe a little bit about the authors. Their background gives their perspective, well, a lot of weight.
Definitely. Milton Friedman, I mean, Nobel Prize winner, huge figure in the Chicago School of Economics, decades of really rigorous work, especially on money, on monetary policy.
A real giant in the field.
Yeah.
But what's key, I think, is that he didn't just stay in academia. He wanted to talk to everyone. This book actually came out of a big 10-part TV series he did for PBS back in 1980.
Yeah, that public engagement piece is huge. He took these complex ideas and made them accessible.
And that's where Rose Friedman comes in, right? His wife.
Yeah.
She wasn't just a collaborator. She was an economist, too.
Absolutely. A skilled economist herself.
Mm.
And her crucial role, it seems, was translating Milton's, let's face it, sometimes dense academic work into language that was clear, persuasive. Something a general audience could really grab onto.
It sounds like a perfect partnership, really. His rigor, her clarity.
Exactly. You had the academic weight combined with this talent for public persuasion made their work incredibly powerful.
Okay, so let's get into the book itself. What's the absolute core idea if you had to boil Free to Choose down?
It's that economic freedom isn't just nice to have, it's the foundation. The foundation for prosperity, for innovation, and crucially for political freedom, too.
And they frame it as a choice, don't they, between two ways of organizing things.
Right. Two basic ways society coordinates itself, either through coercion, you know, central planning, government telling people what to do, or through voluntary cooperation, the free market way.
And they come down pretty hard on government intervention, even when it's meant well.
Oh, definitely. Their argument is that good intentions just aren't enough. The results matter. And they argue time and again that government action, however well-meaning, often backfires, creates unintended consequences that actually hurt the people it's trying to help.
So the alternative is the market.
The free market, yeah. Driven by voluntary exchange, by the price system. They argue it's just fundamentally smarter, more efficient than any central plan, because prices act like this incredible decentralized information system.
Communicating value, scarcity, all that stuff.
All that stuff, constantly, across millions, billions of people. No single planner, no committee could ever possibly know all that information. It's just too complex.
Which leads us perfectly into one of the most famous parts of the book, doesn't it? The pencil example.
Ah, the pencil. Yes. It's such a brilliant illustration. It makes the abstract idea of market coordination totally concrete.
So the challenge is, can any single person actually make a pencil, start to finish?
And the answer is no. A resounding no. Think about it. The wood comes from someone who cuts trees. The graphite might be mined in, say, Sri Lanka. The little metal band, the eraser, the paint.
Thousands of people involved, all over the world, different languages, different motivations.
Exactly. And none of them necessarily care about making a pencil. They care about trading their skill, their resource for something they want. And yet, they cooperate.
Through prices.
Through prices. Through voluntary exchange. It's what the Friedmans call spontaneous order. It just happens without a command center, without anyone dictating it. It's kind of a miracle, really.
And it shows for them how much more effective the market is than trying to plan everything from the top down.
Precisely. And they use this idea, this contrast between spontaneous order and central control to look at history, specifically the Great Depression.
Right, because the common story is that the Depression showed capitalism failing catastrophically.
That's the narrative they directly challenge. They argue, no, it wasn't a failure of the free market. It was a massive, tragic failure of government, specifically government monetary policy.
So they flip the script entirely. It becomes a case study in government failure, not market failure.
That's their argument, a huge one.
How did government policy cause it, according to them? What was the mechanism?
It boils down to the Federal Reserve. Milton Friedman's research, which won him the Nobel, concluded the Fed made catastrophic errors. They allowed the amount of money in the economy, the money supply, to shrink by about a third between 1929 and 1933.
A third? That's huge.
Massive. It basically starved the economy of the liquidity it needed. So what might have been a typical, maybe even severe recession, turned into this absolute decade-long disaster. The government's actions, in their view, prevented the market's natural recovery.
Wow. Okay. So from that big picture, macro stuff, they also drill down into social programs, right?
Yeah.
The chapter Cradle to Grave, critiquing the welfare state.
Yes. And again, the theme is often good intentions leading to bad results.
Hmm.
Programs meant to help the poor, they argue, can end up trapping them in dependency, creating huge inefficient bureaucracies.
And they have that framework, the four ways to spend money. That really clarifies their point about government spending, doesn't it?
It does. It's very simple but powerful. Let's walk through it quickly. One, you spend your money on yourself. You're careful about cost and quality, right?
Makes sense.
Two, you spend your money on someone else, like buying a gift. You're probably still careful about the cost, maybe less so about the perfect quality for them.
Okay.
Three, someone spends their money on you, maybe like a company expense account dinner. You definitely care about the quality, maybe less about the cost.
Right. Someone else is paying.
Exactly. And then there's number four, you spend someone else's money on someone else. And this, they say, is where most government welfare spending fits.
Ah, the bureaucrat spending taxpayer money on a recipient.
Precisely. And in that scenario, the spender, the bureaucrat, has very little incentive to care about either the cost or the quality of the outcome for the recipient because it's not their money and they're not
right.
The beneficiary.
So waste and inefficiency are almost baked into the system. In their view.
That's the argument. It's not about bad people. It's about misaligned incentives.
So what was their proposed alternative then, instead of this complex web of programs?
Their main idea was something called the negative income tax, or NIT.
Okay. How does the NIT work, simply put?
The goal is simplicity and better incentives. Instead of having separate programs for housing, food, job training, each with its own rules and staff, the NIT just provides a basic income floor through the tax system.
So if your income is below a certain point, the government sends you money, a negative tax payment.
Exactly. Direct cash. And crucially, the way it's designed, as you start earning money, the benefit reduces gradually, not all at once.
Ah, so you don't face that cliff where earning an extra dollar means losing a dollar or more in benefits.
Right. It ensures you always keep a significant chunk of any extra money you earn. It preserves the incentive to work, unlike some traditional welfare programs, they argue. And it respects dignity. People get cash and decide for themselves what they need most rather than having bureaucrats decide for them.
Interesting. And they apply a similar logic about monopolies and lack of choice to education, don't they?
They do. Chapter 6, What's Wrong with Our Schools? Their diagnosis is pretty stark. The system suffers because it's largely a government monopoly.
Meaning lack of competition leads to lower quality.
Lower quality, less innovation, schools being unresponsive to parents and students.
Right.
Because where else are you going to go?
Right.
Especially if you don't have a lot of money.
Which leads them to advocate for school vouchers.
Exactly. The idea is the government provides funding, but the money follows the child. Parents get a voucher, and they can use it to pay tuition at any approved school, public, private, religious, whatever.
Introducing competition.
That's the key. Empowering parents as consumers, it forces schools to actually compete for students by offering better quality, better services. If they don't improve, they risk losing students and funding. They saw it as especially important for poorer families stuck in failing schools.
Okay, one more big area.
Yeah.
Inflation. Milton Friedman is almost synonymous with a specific view on this.
He absolutely is. His famous line, inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon.
Meaning it's about the money supply.
Mm.
Not greedy companies or unions or oil shocks, fundamentally.
Mm. Fundamentally, no. Those things can affect relative prices, sure. But widespread, sustained inflation, they argue, only happens when the government increases the quantity of money faster than the economy is producing actual goods and services.
Yeah.
Too much money chasing too few goods.
So inflation is like a tax, a hidden tax.
That's exactly how they frame it. It's a way for governments to finance spending without explicitly raising taxes, which is politically unpopular.
Yeah.
They just print more money or have the central bank create it. And this tax falls hardest on people with fixed incomes, the poor, the elderly.
And the cure, then, isn't trying to control prices or wages directly.
No, they saw those controls as disastrous, causing shortages and distortions. The cure is controlling the growth of the money supply, having stable, predictable rules for monetary policy, removing the temptation for politicians or central bankers to just hit the print button.
Okay, stepping back from the specific chapters, what are the big overarching themes you think the Friedmans really wanted readers, wanted you to take away from Free to Choose?
Well, the first one we mentioned right at the start, but it's central. That indivisible link between economic and political freedom.
You can't really have one without the other, in their view.
Right. If the government controls your job, your resources, your access to basic needs, how free are you really to criticize that government? Economic freedom diffuses power. It creates independent centers of influence that can challenge the state. It's a bulwark for liberty.
It makes you think, doesn't it? When you see economic controls increasing, you have to ask, what's the potential impact on political freedom down the line?
Absolutely. The second big theme relates to that pencil story, spontaneous order versus central planning. The market coordinates millions, using dispersed knowledge through prices in a way no planner could possibly replicate.
So it teaches a kind of humility, skepticism about grand, top-down plans.
I think so. Skepticism about anyone claiming they have the plan to fix complex social problems. Progress often bubbles up from below unexpectedly through individual actions and voluntary cooperation.
And the third theme?
This one is maybe the most practical guideline. Judge policies by results, not intentions.
Ah, the road to hell is paved with good intentions idea applied to economics.
Pretty much. They constantly point to examples, minimum wage intended to help low-skilled workers, but potentially pricing them out of jobs. Rent control meant to make housing affordable, but often shrinking the supply and quality of housing. The intentions might be noble, but you have to look at the likely consequences.
They were really good at coining memorable phrases for these ideas, too.
Oh, definitely. The book is full of them. Real aphorisms.
One that always sticks with me is about equality and freedom. Something like, the society that puts equality before freedom will end up with neither.
The society that puts freedom before equality will end up with a great measure of both.
Yeah, that's a powerful one.
What's the deeper meaning there, do you think? I think it's arguing that trying to force equality of outcome requires massive coercion. It means taking from some to give to others, controlling choices. And that process, they argue, stifles the very freedom that generates prosperity and opportunity in the first place. Freedom allows for equality of opportunity, which leads to more overall prosperity, even if outcomes aren't identical.
And that other famous one about spending money.
Ah, yes. So simple, so true. Nobody spends somebody else's money as carefully as he spends his own.
That just perfectly captures their critique of government bureaucracy and waste, doesn't it?
It really does. It explains why incentives matter so much. When it's not your money, the care factor just isn't the same.
Okay, so bringing this home for the listener, how can you apply these ideas, this Friedman framework, in everyday life?
Well, one obvious way is in how you evaluate political promises or news about policy. Ask those two questions we mentioned. Is this policy expanding individual choice, or is it increasing government control?
And what are the likely unintended consequences, not just the stated goals?
Exactly. Look beyond the good intentions. Think about the incentives being created. Then, on a personal level, understanding inflation as a monetary issue, well, it has implications for your finances.
Like, don't just let cash sit there losing value over time.
Right. It highlights why just holding cash long-term is generally a losing strategy. It encourages you to think about investing, finding ways to make your money grow faster than the currency is being potentially debased.
And for parents, that education chapter is pretty provocative.
It encourages parents to see themselves not just as passive recipients of whatever the local school offers, but as active consumers of education, to demand quality, to look for alternatives, maybe support things like school choice or vouchers if that aligns with their view.
Be proactive about your child's education.
Yes. And finally, just fostering a general awareness, maybe a bit of skepticism, about claims that only government regulation can ensure safety or quality.
Because market mechanisms matter too.
Sure.
Reputation, competition.
Exactly. Sometimes those market forces, wanting to keep customers happy, wanting to build a good reputation, are actually stronger incentives for businesses to do the right thing than just complying with a rule book. Plus, regulators can sometimes get too close to the industries they oversee, what's called regulatory capture.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, what's maybe one final thought or takeaway that really struck you from revisiting Free to Choose?
For me, it's the insistence that the free market isn't just about efficiency. It's actually a moral system. It's based on voluntary interaction, not coercion. It respects people as individuals capable of making their own choices and bearing the consequences. It's fundamentally about cooperation, not conflict.
That's a great point. For me, it's still the power of that pencil story. It's just such a simple, elegant way to illustrate this incredibly complex idea of spontaneous order. It makes you appreciate the intricate web of cooperation that underlies, well, everything around us, even the simplest things. It's mind-boggling, really, that it works without a central director.
It really is.
So maybe the final message for you, the listener, is to carry that healthy dose of skepticism about concentrated power and always try to judge policies by their likely results, not just the promises made.
Well said. Thanks for diving into this with me.
Thank you, and thank you all for listening. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Accotra Foundation.